Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You are now listening to the Calcio Corner podcast with your host, Raffaele.
What's good? This is indeed the Calcio Corner podcast, where we cover all corners of Italian football and more. My name is Raffaele. I thank you for taking the time to listen to this, the 41st episode of the Calcio Corner podcast. Please be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Audioboom. Be sure to give me a follow on Twitter. My account is at ItalianoCalcio. Also check the link in my Twitter bio for all the links that you need to help support and listen to this podcast. So I'm going to have on two guests, two interviews on this episode, action-packed episode. First guest is going to be Patrick Kendrick. He's one of the voices of Serie A. You'll definitely recognize his voice when you hear him. I'll get his thoughts on what's happening in Italy this season. Also going to have Jonathan Johnson on. He does an outstanding job covering French football for CBS Sports. We'll get his thoughts on what's been going on with PSG, their big win over Barcelona. We'll talk some Moise Keane as well, and certainly connect it to the Calcio world. All right, guys, I'm happy to announce that Manscaped are a sponsor of the Calcio Corner podcast. Manscaped are the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision engineered tools for your family jewels. They obsess over their technology developments to provide you with the best tools for your grooming experience. Manscaped is trusted by over 2 million men worldwide. 2 million men. So what are you waiting for? I have an exclusive offer for my listeners. You can get 20% off plus free shipping with the code CALCIOCORNER at manscaped.com. One word, no space. The code is CALCIOCORNER. That's C-A-L-C-I-O corner. You can go to their site and order some of their great products right now as you're listening to this podcast. Manscaped has created the best below-the-waist hair trimmer ever, the Lawnmower 3.0. Their third-generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin-safe technology. In addition, this trimmer comes with an LED light for a more precise shave, and what I think is the best feature on it is that it's waterproof to make your shower shave nice and clean, nice and easy. The Lawnmower 3.0 comes inside their brand new Perfect Package 3.0, which comes with everything, and I mean everything you need to keep trim, cut free, and smelling nice down there. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code CALCIOCORNER at manscaped.com. That's one word, CALCIOCORNER. The link and promo code information can be found in the description of this podcast, so be sure to check that out right now as you're listening. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code CALCIOCORNER at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And make sure you use the code CALCIOCORNER. Unlock your confidence and always, always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. All right, so we will start off this 41st episode of the podcast by talking about Juventus and their shortcomings in their Champions League game against Porto. So Juventus, they lost 2-1 in Portugal against Porto, and now we'll have some work to do in the second leg, which will obviously be played in Italy. If you didn't see this game, it was kind of a weird one, and honestly, didn't miss anything too exciting. It wasn't much of an exciting game. Porto scored in the opening minute of the game off a sloppy play between Bentancur and Chesney. And then in the opening minute, ironically enough, of the second half, Juventus again conceded to put themselves down 2-0. Federico Chiesa, he scored a late goal. It was a big away goal to give Juventus some life heading into that second leg in a few weeks, which again will be played in Italy. Now, my thoughts on this one, Juventus, they played a really poor game. It was one of their worst performances under Andrea Pirlo, in my opinion. A lot was made about, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo returning to Portugal, and he was so excited about, you know, returning home to play this Champions League game, and he played a really poor game. He completely laid a stinker. The only other game that really sticks out in my mind when I saw Ronaldo play this poorly, you know, this season was that loss in Serie A against Inter a few weeks back when he was totally, you know, taken out of the game and neutralized by Inter. He was essentially a non-factor in this game against Porto. There was a moment, I think it was late in the game after the Chiesa goal, where a ball kind of fell, you know, pretty good to him, and Ronaldo took a swipe at the ball with his foot and absolutely whiffed and missed it. and maybe could have got a good shot on target and potentially equalized this game for Juve, but he totally missed on that. And, you know, when you consider Ronaldo, he's been nothing but money for Juventus in the Champions League ever since he signed with them a few seasons back, but he really came up short in this one. And, you know, boy, they really could have used that special performance from Ronaldo in the Champions League, considering they got nothing from anybody really around him. So it was certainly not the time for Ronaldo to lay an egg. But, you know, I guess we got to give Porto some credit for, you know, maybe causing Ronaldo to put in this poor performance. Juventus, they are very fortunate, though, because Porto, you know, outside of the opening minute in each half, they really also played a poor performance themselves and, you know, did not take advantage of trying to put Juventus to bed and, you know, making that second leg deficit for Juve to overcome really a challenging one. That late Chiesa away goal keeps the Bianconeri very much in this matchup. And again, considering how poor Porto look, you know, they don't scare you heading into that second leg, really. All Juve need is a 1-0 win at home to advance in the Champions League, and we all know that Juve are certainly capable of getting a 1-0 result at home. Again, I know Juve looked poorly, but Porto did not instill any fear in this Juve side either. That first goal was kind of a freak goal between, you know, mistake between Bentancur and Chesney, as I mentioned. That second goal in the opening minute of the second half, Juve just caught flat-footed or whatever the case coming out the gate. So certainly avoidable situations for Juve in the second leg. So I do think Juve are in a very good position to advance out of the this matchup with Porto. And what we saw against Porto the other day is kind of what we've seen from Juve, though, throughout this season at various points, right? Perhaps not at this level of bad what we saw against Porto, but other than this recent run Juve have been on where they have looked better and they have kind of moved up the Serie A table up until that Napoli loss last weekend, Juventus, they have not been that dominant team that overpowers their opponents, something that we've, you know, grown accustomed to during this, you know, 9-year run of dominance by Juve. Now, again, I still believe that this is a side good enough to get the result they need against Porto in the second leg. I do expect them to advance the next round. And assuming they do advance, you know, obviously a lot depends on what team they draw, as that's always the case in the Champions League. But barring some dramatic turnaround from this Juve side, this is not a Juventus side that's going to win the Champions League this season. You know, no shot, given how they've looked this season, that they're going to be the, you know, the team at the end hoisting that Champions League trophy. So I would ask you this. Let's assume Juve don't win the Champions League. And let's say they don't win the Scudetto, because I don't see them winning the Scudetto. I just don't see that. I think a lot of people have hung on to the notion that they are Juventus, that they've won 9 titles in a row, that they'll figure it out eventually. But I just don't think that this Juve side is good enough this season. They're not playing consistently enough. On top of the fact that when you consider just how good and competitive of a Serie A season this is and how many teams are competing towards the top of the standings, I just don't think the things are working in favor for Juve to win the Scudetto. So let's assume no Champions League title, no Scudetto trophy for Juve this season. They've already won the Italian Super Cup over Napoli. They're in the final of Coppa Italia. And let's say that they win that. Let's say they go on to beat Atalanta. So if this season, all they win is those two trophies, the Italian Super Cup, the Coppa Italia, and you know they do finish top four, let's say they qualify for Champions League next season. But I could certainly imagine also a scenario in which they don't finish top four because, again, there are a lot of teams competing towards the top and a lot of good competitive sides. So Champions League trophy, no. Scudetto trophy, no. Just the Italian Super Cup, just Coppa Italia. They do finish top four. They're in Champions League next season. Are you bringing back Andrea Pirlo? Is he your coach at Juve next season? That's what I would ask you. And I said it at the time. I think Juventus took a huge risk in hiring him, you know, hiring this totally new, inexperienced coach in Pirlo. And I'm not knocking Pirlo. I wasn't knocking him at the time. He has to start coaching somewhere. But I just don't think from the Juventus standpoint, you know, it was worth having him get that start in the coaching world at your club. This is like, you know, giving a totally new driver who just got his or her license, the keys to a Ferrari. You know, you're probably not going to want to give this brand new driver the keys to a Ferrari right away. You're going to want to maybe start them off with a Nissan or something like that. Now, you could fire Pirlo, you know, assuming what I laid out, that scenario I laid out happens, and bring in a more experienced coach and, you know, in hopes of, you know, this experienced coach helping Juve get back to winning Serie A next season and making that deep run into the Champions League that's the expectation that there is. Or do you maybe stick with Pirlo? You know, now technically he has some experience and you could argue, you know, why would you fire him now? You were willing to, you know, roll the dice with him when he was a totally new coach, you know, and had no experience. Now he's had some experience under his belt this season. He's learning. Whether you like the growth you're seeing from Pirlo, you don't like, that's certainly going to go into your decision. But maybe bring him back next season. Let him now, with this year under his belt, everything he's learned, the mistakes he's made, the good decisions he's made, let's see if he could piece this together in year two and get Juventus back to, as I said, you know, the top of Serie A, back to making that deep run in the Champions League. So that's kind of, you know, the scenario that I would kind of pose out there to you guys. Of course, we have, you know, plenty of time to go in this season. We have to continue to evaluate this Juve team, see how they play out from now until the end of the season. How does Pirlo continue to grow and mature as a coach? I threw out a lot of, you know, what if scenarios, and in the end, we have to just wait to see what actually happens. But I'm just curious to get your take. Do Juventus bring back Pirlo next season? Certainly let me know on Twitter what your thoughts are. Would you like to see Pirlo back as the coach of Juve? You know my Twitter handle. You could always tweet on me at Italiano Calcio what you think Juve should do with Pirlo next season. All right, so the first guest I'm going to have on this episode is Patrick Kendrick. He does a great job calling Serie A games. You'll definitely recognize his voice. We'll talk the upcoming Milan Derby. We'll talk what's going on in Napoli, the Scudetto race. We'll even talk some Spezia and more. So you definitely want to stay tuned for this interview. So let me welcome in my guest on the Calcio Corner podcast, Mr. Patrick Kendrick. How are you doing today, Patrick?
I'm very well, thank you, Raffaele.
All right, you do an outstanding job calling Serie A games, and obviously you follow the league very closely. So I wanted to get you on to talk about some of the, you know, the hot Calcio topics that have been going on right now this season. Big game this weekend. It is Milan versus Inter. Inter recently overtook Milan for first place. What are your thoughts on this game on Sunday? And does an Inter win, which would put them 4 points clear, does that maybe mean that they're totally in control of perhaps winning the Scudetto this season?
I think it would definitely make them favourites. I don't think it would necessarily put them in complete control. I mean, 4 points can be eroded away quite quickly. I remember just before Christmas, I think Milan's cushion was 4 points, and that went very quickly as well. You know, you only need to draw a couple of games, and before you know it, that gap is whittled down a bit. But certainly it would give Inter momentum. I think that it's already been a big psychological boost for them to go into the derby ahead of Milan. No mm-hmm. one saw the Rossoneri losing at Spezia, simply because Spezia had only lost had only won once at home all season. They had produced some surprising results, but those had typically been on the road because they're quite a good counter-attacking team. But this is a big test for Milan now, especially because, you know, they didn't get the result that they wanted in Serbia either. So it does mean that suddenly they lost at Spezia, they drew in the Europa League, they need to make a statement. This is more important for Milan to win this game than Inter. I think Inter would probably take a draw mm-hmm. Before the game if you offered it to them. Although, lest we forget, Milan won the reverse fixture 2-1, so it would be in Inter's best interest to win this match, to overturn the head-to-head result if they can get that in their favour by winning with a two-goal cushion or perhaps by winning with several goals, then mm-hmm. then that would certainly help them, I think. Otherwise, a draw keeps the status quo, keeps Inter a point ahead, but Milan know that they have a better head-to-head record, so they only then have to catch up 1 point. So it's absolutely fascinating, and I don't think it's only down to those two teams either. I think had Roma fared better against some of the sides in the top seven, they would be very much in the conversation. But it's hard to make that argument simply because I think their efforts against the other sides in the top seven have just left them too much to do. They'd have to finish at least a point above everyone because their head-to-head record against all the other sides in the top seven is going to be inferior. But never counts against Juventus. I mean, lest we forget, I think we're going into match day 23. It's a 38-game season, and there's a long mm-hmm. way to go. I think there's 48 more points to play for. So it's not done and dusted yet, but clearly an Inter win, putting them 4 points clear, gives them all the momentum. And as it's been mentioned many times, they're out of Europe completely. They're out of the Coppa Italia. It's one game a week, and there are a few coaches better at preparing a team for one match a week than Antonio Conte. And they have a very deep squad as well.
Yeah, I think the last point you kind of mentioned, how they're just all they have to compete for is Serie A. So I think that definitely gives them an advantage over Milan, Juve, and some of these other teams that also have the European commitment as well. Another team that perhaps some people thought or had their mixed feelings in terms of whether they could compete for the Scudetto was Napoli heading into the season. And a lot of people have their opinions on Gattuso and the job he's done. Do you think there's any realistic scenario in which we could see Gattuso back as their coach next season, or do you think his fate is already kind of determined that he'll be out at the end of the season?
I think they have to finish the season really strongly now. They need to overturn that deficit against Granada, which is going to be easier said than done. A 2-0 away loss is not what the doctor ordered. So first of all, they need to try and get through to the last 16 of the Europa League. That's an uphill battle. And then they need to not only get that top four finish, but they need to finish the campaign really strongly. And by that, I mean they need to show form between now and May, whereby De Laurentiis and the Napoli hierarchy say, OK, if we can produce this form consistently from February through to May, then that gives us maybe a sort of laying the groundwork, really, for a title challenge next season. I mean, Napoli, lest we forget, started the season so well. I mean, some real standout results. All right, 6-0 against Genoa. That was slightly overshadowed by what happened next. Genoa had that 14-case COVID outbreak. But, you know, big wins at home over Roma. There was the big win at home over Atalanta. They've had some really impressive results. Most recently, that narrow win over Juventus. It's so frustrating if you're a Napoli fan, and I have lots of friends that are, because you just do not know what's going to happen with this team. You never know which side is going to turn up. It's a bit of a cliche. But I think that must be the most frustrating thing for Gattuso, first and foremost, but also for everyone connected with the club, the players, the president, who we know is quite a difficult character to deal with. But I would suggest, if you get rid of Gattuso, who do you bring in? I'm not sure there's necessarily anyone better on the market. I'm not a fan of going back and getting a previous coach. I used to work for Benfica. They've gone back and got Jorge Jesus. That's not working out well at all. I'm not sure Sarri would necessarily be welcomed back with open arms, despite the fact he did very well. Benitez has everything to prove. I think when you do go to the Far East, you know, it does leave a slight question mark over what your ambitions are. And so we'll see. I mean, personally, I like Gattuso. I was, I have to say, I probably did him a disservice in that I just thought he was a man manager, a sort of Mr. Motivator type figure, because I was basing all of my interpretation of his coaching credentials on the way he played the game. But I think he did a very good job at Milan. He was one point away from getting them into the top four. And he almost overachieved in that job. Then he was out of work. And, you know, Napoli took a punt on him as a difficult task. All right, Napoli were in disarray after that mutiny with Ancelotti. But it can't be easy to replace someone who's been a mentor of yours, like he had with Ancelotti. I thought he conducted himself with dignity there. Thought he handled it very well. And I also got the opportunity to interview him about January 2020, so just over a year ago. And he was great company. He's a big thinker about the game. He's very switched on. And he really impressed me. I came away from that thinking, okay, this guy can win trophies. And then he went on to win the Coppa Italia. And I did actually expect Napoli to mount a challenge for the Scudetto this season. And, you know, maybe with that win over Juventus, that they can go on a run. They still obviously have that other game against Juventus, which is their game in hand. If they could win that as well, suddenly they've got a better head-to-head record against Juventus. They've taken 6 points off the champions, but they almost need to win out their games now for the next 10 to 15 matches. They need to go on a Lazio-style run that we saw with Lazio last season. And then maybe they're in the shake-up. If they're 4 to 6 points off come late March, early April, then maybe they can still force their way into the title race. But it's a tricky one. I personally would stick with Gattuso. The issue you have is he signed an 18-month contract when he first came in. Throughout November, throughout December, there's been a 36-page, I think it is, draft contract ready for him to sign. That's been there prepared by the lawyers, both him and the club, for several months now. And every time they get a bad result, which is all too frequently of late, then that just gets pushed back, and De Laurentiis is sort of keeping him guessing. And you can understand why. It's a big financial commitment. If you were to give him a 2 or a 3 year contract, then suddenly you've got maybe a 10 million euro sort of Damocles hanging over your head, unless you go the route that we've seen in the past with clubs like with Palermo and Genoa, and you decide to, you know, you're going to have 2 or 3 coaches on the payroll and then just bring them in when you need a boost. But that's not really Napoli's style. That's not De Laurentiis' style. So I think they'll probably give him until the end of the season, whatever happens, to prove himself, unless they're in real danger of slipping out of the top seven. But Sassuolo have lost touch, really. And because it's a Juventus-Atalanta final in the Coppa Italia, I think the top seven should all get Europe one way or another. But it would be great to see Napoli back in the Champions League, because I think that just tends to lift the whole club. And it also almost counterintuitively helps their league form on the basis they're playing quality opposition week in, week out. I know it's tough to juggle both competitions, but in some ways the Europa League can really hurt you. You know, between the scheduling, playing Thursday, Sunday, you know, you're often playing after your direct rivals, which doesn't help psychologically, but it just can be very tiring. It's because it's Thursday, Sunday, it's not quite the same as playing Tuesday, Saturday, or sometimes you might even get to play Tuesday, Sunday if you're lucky, or even Wednesday, Monday. I know you can play Thursday, Monday as well, but I think that Champions League qualification is huge for Gattuso. If he has any chance of staying in the job, he needs to secure a top four finish.
Yeah, I've been advocating that. I think Napoli need to qualify for the Champions League this season. That missing it 2 years in a row would certainly not bode well for, you know, the project that they've been embarking on over the past few seasons. Let's assume perhaps Gattuso doesn't come back. I know a few names that have been linked to the Napoli job in the Italian media have been Ivan Juric and Vincenzo Italiano, who we'll talk about in a little bit. But you mentioned an interesting name on Twitter that caught my eye. You mentioned Fabio Cannavaro's name. Do you actually think Cannavaro would be a potentially good option to replace Gattuso at Napoli?
I don't, to be honest. That was slightly tongue-in-cheek, if I'm honest. I mean, I quite like Cannavaro. I thought he was a fabulous player, and he's obviously a very proud Neapolitan. Although that would be great to see him take charge. You know, maybe he'd have his brother as his assistant. You know, there would be a nice sort of legacy there. But I actually think, you know, Naples is such a romantic city that would almost be a nice appointment in some ways, albeit, you know, Cannavaro, like so many players, you know, went and left and sort of made their fortunes elsewhere. And I know it's never quite the same for players like him and Ciro Ferrara, you know, that then became synonymous with Juventus, you know, because such is the disdain for the Bianconeri down there. But I actually think, and it's another point I made on Twitter a few weeks ago, the most successful hire for Napoli in recent years was Sarri, and that was De Laurentiis, and I think Giuntoli actually saying, you know, going to the provinces, so to speak, you know, and going to one of those less fashionable mid-table sides. And he'd done such a good job at Empoli, and they saw something there. They thought, okay, this guy gets more out of the players that he has at his disposal than necessarily they should be producing on paper. He has a very clearly defined tactical system. We like what he's doing. And I think that another appointment of that style would probably help Napoli, because you go into it with fewer expectations. You're not going for someone on the basis of their playing career or because they're a name. You're going on the basis of their excellent coaching credentials. Mm-hmm. And Vincenzo Italiano got double promotion. I think it was Trapani down in Serie C before Spezia. He's doing really well in his first job in the top tier. Juric is a weird one because he didn't do particularly well at Genoa, but he was excellent at Crotone, and now he's doing a fabulous job at Verona, and two seasons in a row, and that squad was completely decimated. Yep. But Juric is a Gasperini disciple. You know, it's a very unique style of play. And when they're playing expansive football, it's great to watch. When they're not scoring goals, and Verona have had issues, you know, finding the back of the net, I'm just wondering if that's the best fit. I mean, tactically, when it works, it's great to see, you know, as we saw at the Bentegodi when Verona beat Napoli 3-1. But when teams find a way of counteracting that, I'm not necessarily sure what Juric does there. I really like to see Italiano, and I think, and Napoli fans aren't going to like me for this, but that could be the perfect next job for him, because I think he's going to go really far. And if he goes from Spezia to Napoli, does 2 or 3 years at Napoli, does well, wins a trophy, or consistently coaches in the Champions League, then suddenly he could be, you know, Juventus could come calling, or one of the Milan clubs, which is still the biggest pull in the Italian game. Or maybe he wants to go abroad. I mean, I've been very impressed with what I've seen. Maybe you want to wait until the end of the season, see where Spezia end up. It would be a risky appointment. These ones always are. But he comes in on a lesser salary. The other name, which is an obvious one, is De Zerbi, because he played for Napoli, albeit I think it was only for a season. He himself, you know, was an attacking player. He produces an attacking brand of football. I don't really like the way that Sassuolo and his teams defend, to be honest. He can be quite gung-ho. I mean, we saw it at Benevento as well. But there's a lot to be said for someone like him. There are some great coaches in Serie A at this moment in time, which doesn't really help Gattuso's future prospects. Right. But I think that's probably the way to go with the hire. It's a lower risk option in terms of the money, the outlay that you have to make from a financial perspective. And you can get someone in with the idea of building a project. The problem is that Ancelotti was just over a season. We're looking like Gattuso might be just over a season, you know, 18 months. I think Napoli needs someone to stay in the job for 3 or 4 years, you know, much like Sarri did. And that's when you get best results. I mean, it's an old adage in football, but, you know, time is hugely important. Unless someone's doing a terrible job, give them time. As long as they're on course for the minimum objective, then, you know, there is something to work with.
No, I agree. The stability is important. That's why I never fully understood the rumors of firing Gattuso this season. It's not like Napoli had been doing so horrible and were so far off the pace that, you know, it justified firing him before the end of the season. At least I've been advocating, give him till the end of the season, see where everything is at the end of the season, and then make your evaluations. So we talked about Italiano. So Spezia have been, you know, one of the amazing stories this season, and a lot of praise has been heading towards Vincenzo Italiano's way. His philosophy that he's talked about in the past is like this all playmaker approach. He wants all his players to be able to handle the ball and whatnot. What does this philosophy kind of mean more in depth? And what have you seen from the Spezia side and from Vincenzo Italiano that has really impressed you?
Well, the philosophy is actually born out of his own playing career. He's a deep thinker about the game. And I read his dissertation. It was great because the Fijici, the Italian FA, post-select dissertations, and his was published the same day as Pirlo's. And not to do a disservice to the Juventus coach, but there was a lot more in Italiano's one. The only disappointing thing was that there were a lot of video sort of animation, a lot of clips in there that unfortunately, because it was saved as a PDF, you couldn't actually watch. It would have been great to have actually seen him present or defend his dissertation, you know, start the clips and then and talk over them. But there was certainly enough in there in terms of the way he explained it. And there were some really key ideas which came to the fore, one of which was he himself was a regista in his playing career, deep-lying playmaker. And he said, I noticed in my own career how frustrating it was when the opposition were just able to mark me out of the game. They just put someone on me and they starved me of time and space, and that had a knock-on effect, and my team didn't play as well accordingly. So I endeavoured really to make sure that that would never be an issue that my teams would face when I was coaching, which is why I have this idea of all 11 players need to be able to fulfill that role of regista. I want players all over the pitch that can dictate the tempo, that can set the play. And I think it's a wonderful idea. I mean, it's very easy to say in theory. In practice, it's a lot harder to reproduce, especially with the players that he's got available to him. But Spezia have been great. I mean, the way things work for me personally is I tend to do, when I do Spezia, it's against the bigger teams. So I did Inter Spezia, and they were beaten 2-1. They got a late goal from Piccoli. I did the Napoli Spezia game, as I'm sure you'll remember, unfortunately. Yep. And, you know, that was, I didn't see that result coming. That was, yeah, slightly, it didn't really tell the whole story. Risultato bugiardo, as they say in this part of the world. But yeah, it's impressive. I like the fact they've got three kids from the academy in there with Maggiore, Vignali and Bastoni, you know, two of whom scored against Milan. Enzola's been a revelation up front. Provedel's been fantastic in goal, which wasn't really the plan at the start. It was Jeroen Zoet that they brought in to play in goal. He got injured, then Provedel came in and has made that position their own. But just some smart recruitment as well. Ricci, I think, who was at the Roma Academy, he's been great as that sort of playmaker. And one thing you know is if you've got a head coach who himself was a playmaker during his playing career. I apologize for the sirens going.
No, that's all right.
Unfortunately, it's the times we live in. But if you've got a head coach who himself was a deep-lying playmaker who wants everyone in the team to be able to perform and be good on the ball, then you know that the player who's given that role as the regista is going to be very good on the ball. And I think Ricci's fantastic and dynamic. And it's just, it's good recruitment. It's interesting to see what happens now with the new ownership, with the American group coming in. They're punching above their weight, but that's what you have to do on limited resources. If you are going to get promoted and you are going to survive in Serie A, you need to do something different. You have to be true to your principles, because we've seen time and time again over the years that the well-worn path of simply bringing in players that almost seem to have 6 or 7 relegations on their CVs, and that's very, I don't want to do a disservice and I don't want to sort of insult those players, but there are probably 20 to 30 players that have 5 or 6 relegations on their CV simply because they're almost too good for Serie B and not quite good enough for Serie A. So one season, maybe they're part of a promotion winning campaign. There's almost two groups. There's the groups that are constantly helping teams to get promoted from the second tier, but then they're discarded when that team goes up because they're not considered good enough. And then there are the other players who have Serie A experience. So often teams look to them. You know, I think about someone like Luca Rossettini, who was playing like for a different club every year for six or seven years. And he himself had a very good career for a number of years. But then as time wore on, and I think it's better now, I like what Spezia are doing, to use your academy players, give them an opportunity, and maybe also take a gamble on some players from abroad like Nzola. And also, if you can, find those players that are ready to make the step up from the second tier, and above all, reward the players that got you promoted in the first place. It's a lot easier to try and have that continuity in terms of personnel with the squad that got you promoted, as opposed to saying, well, no, now we need some seasoned veterans, guys that have been there and done it at Serie A level. Then you overhaul the whole squad. You have no identity left. And the one thing Spezia have not lost since the start of their season, and unfortunately I didn't see them much in the second tier last term, but I'm sure it's the same. They've stayed true to their values and their footballing identity, and that is all set from Italiano, and that's why he's getting all the plaudits more so than the players, I would suggest.
Oh yeah, whatever they're doing in Spezia, it's certainly working, and I've been really impressed with Vincenzo Italiano, and you know, if Napoli do make a coaching change at the end of the season, I certainly would be advocating to give Italiano a shot in Naples. So we've kind of talked about Spezia. They've been very exciting this season. The Scudetto race is certainly a really compelling story. The battle for the Champions League is also very compelling. What have your overall thoughts been on the season? Is this like by far one of the most entertaining Serie A seasons in a while for you covering it? And what's maybe really stood out to you?
The answer is a tricky one. I'm in a bit of a bind here because the short answer is yes, it is the most exciting season in recent memory. But of course, the massive caveat is the fact that we're in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic and we've got no fans in the stadium. So, you know, if you're watching from afar, it's entertaining. The product and the spectacle itself has obviously, the lack of fans detracts a lot from its visibility and from its engagement and from its enjoyment. But it's been a wonderful season. I don't think anyone expected Milan to be where they are. No. And that's always good. I think Serie A is always going to benefit from the three giants in the north all performing. And, you know, it would have been great to have Juventus right there as well. I still think they'll run both Inter and Milan close for the Scudetto. I think it's between one of those three clubs. But it's wonderful to see that story developing. I'm really enjoying Roma under Paolo Fonseca, because I think that squad is bang average. There's no other way of putting it. When I look at their squad, really, I mean, the first 11 is okay. There are a few standout players in there, but the second string, I mean, he's got performances out of Karsdorp, who had barely played for two seasons, and it's been impressive. You know, they've had Cristante dropping in as a makeshift centre back. They're going to have another defensive crisis this weekend. I'm on their game at Benevento amongst others, and so they've been a really good story. Verona continuing to impress. I didn't expect that whatsoever. I thought they were going to be in a relegation battle when they lost Kumbulla, Rahmani and Amrabat. As you're a Napoli fan, just while we're on that, I'm pleased to see Rahmani getting a bit of game time. I mean, obviously it comes with the COVID-19 test for Koulibaly and the injury to Manolas, but I really couldn't fathom, unless there was something that we weren't seeing going on off the pitch, he couldn't settle in Naples. I really didn't understand why Gattuso was so reluctant to use him, especially given that I think Manolas was rested for the entire Europa League group stage. It was Koulibaly and Maksimovic played every single game. And I did start to question that. What I've liked about Juventus recently is the fact that they almost seem to have two pairings. It's Bonucci and Chiellini and then De Ligt and Demiral. And I wonder whether Napoli might have been able to have paired Koulibaly, paired Maksimovic with Rahmani and then had Koulibaly and Manolas as the league pair. But obviously, hindsight's 20/20. So it's been great, really. I mean, it's been up and down. Genoa looked dead and buried. Now they've been absolute breath of fresh air under Ballardini. Cagliari have just crashed 16 matches without a win now, which is just 15, I think, going on to 16. It's just astonishing, really. So many storylines, and weird how the careers of people like Gianpaolo have just sort of taken a real dive, much like Di Francesco. You know, Gianpaolo did an excellent job at Sampdoria. Didn't work out for him at Milan. You think he's going to bounce back at Torino. He doesn't. Di Francesco probably was about par for the course with Roma. There were some tricky moments, but, you know, lest we forget, he knocked out Barcelona and he took them to a Champions League semi-final. But then he failed at Samp and now he's failing at Cagliari. It's strange. It's a strange thing, momentum, really, in football like that, especially with coaches and a bit with Rolando Moran as well, Cagliari, and then Genoa not quite happening for him. So there's just so many storylines in Serie A. I love the fact that we're almost back to a 90s style Italian top flight where we, you know, maybe it was Parma and Fiorentina in the 90s. Now it's Atalanta and Napoli, but we do have seven sisters again. We've got the Milan clubs, we've got the Rome clubs, we've got Juventus, Napoli and Atalanta, and there's a very clearly defined top seven, and it's a similar situation to the Premier League's Big Six. And I think that is good for the league, to be honest. I think it makes it competitive, and I think it gives those teams continuity in Europe. There will occasionally be a shock, and Sassuolo are knocking on the door. They're trying to break into that pack. But I think it's been a season full of intrigue. There's been storylines everywhere you look, and it's been absolutely fascinating to cover. And we're only, I'm not even sure we're two-thirds of the way through it. So a lot more to come, absolutely.
No, it's definitely been a great season. All right, I'll get you out of here on this. You usually call these Serie A games solo. So you have to, you know, serve both as doing the play-by-play, also kind of analyze the game and provide your opinion on what's going on. Is that difficult for you to do, to kind of play both roles in the commentary booth, or is it something that now you're just used to?
It is difficult, yes, and it continues to be a challenge. I am now used to it. However, a good friend of mine who does a lot of commentary in England, I won't mention his name, but he said to me recently that he'd been doing a lot of solo TV games. And recently he did one with a co-commentator, and he said to me that it was a bit weird just how little he spoke, because, you know, TV, unlike radio commentary, is a lot more about letting the game breathe and less is more. And now I'm sure you'll have people suggesting that I still talk too much. It's the bane of the commentator's existence, really. How much is too much and how little is too little? But in terms of striking that balance, I do enjoy trying to analyze the game tactically. The chief challenge comes with when you have a co-commentator, they're particularly when the games are done as an outside broadcast from the stadium, less so from the studio off tube, where you're at the mercy of the producer and what they're showing you. But when you're at the stadium, the co-commentator will almost sort of disassociate themselves from the ball, and they'll be looking more for patterns of play and how a team is setting up off the ball. And it's a lot harder to do that when you're both the lead commentator and you're having to analyze things, because my main job is to say who's got the ball, who's doing what, and to tell the story. However, it is nice when a goal goes in, because you almost get one chance when you're doing a game with a co-commentator. You call the play live, and then as soon as it cuts to the replay, you go quiet and your colleague comes in and takes the replays. Whereas when you're doing it solo, you almost get three or four goes at calling the goal. You know, if you're up with play, fantastic, and then you're able to find a suitable line and something which tells the story then and there, great. Then you can move on to describing the goal, how it happened, why it happened, who was at fault, or who did a good job in scoring it. But you almost have more time and greater scope to be able to make sure you get those big moments right, because you don't have to necessarily pass the ball, for want of a better expression, or hand over to your colleague. But it is a challenge, because it's 90 minutes of talking to yourself. There's no one to bounce your ideas off. If you misinterpret something, then you've got no sounding board there, no one to say, well, actually, I think that was a handball, or I don't think there was sufficient contact, you know. And so
Right. You've
probably got people at home screaming at the TV being like, how on earth has he missed that? So there are pitfalls to it. There are advantages to it. The biggest thing is you never end up talking over someone or vice versa. And the trickiest thing with a co-commentator is making sure that they get out in time for you to call the big moments, because, you know, and occasionally I might get caught out. I'm talking about something anecdotal because a team is playing it around at the back, and then suddenly there's a killer ball and there's a guy through on goal. And if you're not careful, or if you're looking down at your notes, then you might miss a goal. So touch wood, it's not happened so far this season. But it is a challenge, but it's one I enjoy as well, trying to do both roles, because it does mean that you have to be more tactically astute and aware, and try and look for patterns in the game where possible, as I said, because the main role is, you know, it's TV. People can see what's going on. Most people are educated football fans. They know the game. Often they're watching their own team. So it's a case of trying to tell the story, add to the action, and not necessarily, you know, frustrate people or talk too much or just or bore people. So a whole host of different things are going on in my mind. You can hopefully I've given a bit of an insight there into
for sure.
Into all the segmentali, as we say here, that, you know, it's going on in my, you know, I'm sort of racking my brains as to what to do. And I've got all these, you know, slight psychological hang-ups. Am I saying the right thing? Am I telling the story effectively? How much is too much? But hopefully there are some satisfied customers at home anyway.
No, for sure. You definitely do a great job. And it's always easy for people from the outside to, you know, criticize and say that, oh, I could do a better job. But then when you get put into that position, it's probably not as easy as everybody thinks. So you definitely do a great job.
Thank you very much.
No problem. I want to thank you, Patrick, for taking the time to provide your thoughts and all this great insight on Serie A and all the work you do. So keep up the great work with your commentary, you know, and stay safe. And hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure, Raffaele. Anytime. All the best. Cheers. Bye-bye.
All right, so the next guest I'm going to have on is Jonathan Johnson. He's been on the podcast before. He was actually the first guest I ever had on the Calcio Corner podcast. He does an outstanding job covering primarily French football for CBS Sports, but he also does a great job contributing with their Champions League coverage and Europa League coverage. So you definitely want to stay tuned for this interview with Jonathan Johnson. So let me welcome in my guest on the Calcio Corner podcast, Mr. Jonathan Johnson. How are you doing today, Jonathan?
Hey, I'm very well. Thank you, Raffaele. How are you?
Doing well. It's good to have you back on here. I remember you were my first ever guest on the podcast, and here we are a couple months later, and it's good to have you back.
Pleased to be back, and glad that you're still here.
All right. So you do an outstanding job covering French football, and we just saw PSG put on a tremendous performance against Barcelona. And so I wanted to get you on to talk about this and a little bit more. We all saw that remarkable performance Mbappe put on against Barcelona. Just how special of a performance was it? And was it almost kind of like one of those passing of the torch moments from Messi, perhaps to Mbappe, in terms of, like, you know, the best player to the, you know, the future best player in this world?
I mean, I definitely think there is the possibility for that. Obviously, it was a phenomenal showing. I think in those kind of games, you know, it's one thing to do that in just sort of your average Champions League match or in a group stage game. You know, but to go into such a match where there's so much pressure, so much expectation, you know, the stakes are very high, you know, and to be able to produce that sort of clinical showing is very impressive. And to be honest, it had been overdue a little bit, a big performance by Mbappe, because this season so far has not been the best by his high standards. Whether that's in the Champions League or Ligue 1, you know, in the Champions League in 2020, he went pretty much the entire calendar year without scoring. So, you know, for him to now deliver like that back on the Champions League stage, that's a big boost for him and for PSG. And, you know, it's just great to be able to see him, you know, reconfirming, you know, what we already knew about his talent. And does it feel like a passing of the torch? Sure, it does in a way. You know, obviously the narrative is there. But the thing that I would say is it's not only about Mbappe and Messi in that game. You know, I think you can look a lot at what's going on in the Champions League right now, and it feels like torches are being passed in many different ways. There's Mbappe and there's Messi. You've got Haaland as well with Dortmund. You've got a Cristiano Ronaldo, who's also in decline, like Messi, and traditional superpower clubs like Barcelona and Juventus are now struggling, while these more modern-minded teams like PSG and Dortmund are starting to thrive in Europe.
No, for sure. It's a good point. There's a lot of, like you said, seemingly passing of the torches. And for Mbappe also to do that without Neymar on the field, he felt some added pressure, and he certainly rose to the occasion. So, you know, good to see him put that type of performance on. Alessandro Florenzi, he said on Twitter something to the effect of, you know, that it's not over yet. They still have another game to play against Barcelona. But I mean, you know, to overcome four away goals is certainly a steep mountain for Barcelona to try to overcome. So let's assume they advance past Barcelona. Do you think this PSG team is good enough to go on and win the Champions League this season? I know they were in the finals last year. Are they good enough to maybe win it this year?
I definitely think you have to start taking them seriously. I mean, I think the thing that has always held PSG back on the continental stage has sort of been this mental block you know, that had been built up over the space of a couple of seasons, you know, with the trauma of remontada, then the added disappointments of going out to Real Madrid in the way that they did the season after, and then the, you know, the shame of the capitulation at home against Manchester United after winning away, you know, that did a lot of damage, and PSG have worked hard to try to erase that. Having Neymar back last season, you know, was very important for PSG. And having someone like Mbappe being able to step up in Neymar and Di Maria's absence this season, you know, is also a big deal. So I think PSG are showing signs now that they've matured mentally. You know, they had done so under Tuchel, even though this season the relationship between the squad and the coach seemed a bit more strained than usual. And obviously that resulted in him being replaced. But under Pochettino as well, you know, you can still see that that stronger mentality, and that's something completely different about this PSG, and that's why I think that they are capable of getting back to the final again this season and potentially going one better and actually winning it. But obviously, it's the Champions League, and we all know that so much of clubs making it to the final depends on the draw. We saw PSG get a very favourable path to the final in Lisbon. And perhaps they're going to be up against more challenging opponents this time around, assuming that they do get past Barcelona. I mean, there's not too many people talking up the possibility of remontada coming back, and I think for obvious reasons. You know, Barcelona at the time of remontada already seemed like they were a little bit in decline, you know, a little bloated, you know, perhaps not at their best anymore. So to be talking up this current Barca potentially coming back, I don't think anyone's going to waste their breath, to be perfectly honest. Don't want to tempt fate, but there's so much broken about this Barcelona side, and there's so much talent that seems to have come, you know, to the natural end of its shelf life, that you know, it just feels like Barca are probably going to go to Paris and just try not to be too humiliated, despite the fact that they'll already be very hurt about losing so heavily at home in the first leg.
No, I'd agree. I'd be shocked too if they come back. And I get what Florenzi's saying on Twitter. You know, that's what you want to hear your players. So you don't want them to obviously talk about it's already over and whatnot, and perhaps give Barcelona a little bit of motivation. You mentioned Neymar. You've mentioned Di Maria's name. We've talked about Mbappe. In your opinion, where does this current PSG team kind of rank in comparison to some of the recent ones? When you know, you think back to the players they've had, like Zlatan and Cavani and Lavezzi and Thiago Silva, where does this current one maybe rank in your opinion?
I think that in terms of talent, this is arguably the most talented PSG side that we've seen, certainly under Qatari ownership. They seem to be growing up all the time as well. I mean, you mentioned Florenzi's quote. You know, Kimpembe was saying things along the similar lines as well. It shows that they've grown up. They've realized that, you know, they can't buy into this, you know, this false confidence that they've been guilty of believing in the last couple of years. And that's a big difference. I mean, PSG, in the era of Zlatan, Thiago Motta, Blaise Matuidi, Maxwell, Thiago Silva, you know, it was a very strong team. I'd say it was probably more balanced than the one now, but they didn't have the same level of talent, certainly not going forward in terms of sort of a match-winning capacity. You know, you look at PSG's front line at the moment when everyone's fit, and they're all potential match winners. You know, Mbappe has already proved that. Neymar's proved that. Di Maria's proved that. And even someone like Moise Kean is now showing that, you know, he's also capable of this. It's somebody, you know, who perhaps dropped off of the European radar quite quickly because he exploded at Juve, then moved to Everton, you know, lost his way a little bit, perhaps more culturally than what was happening on the pitch. And now, you know, he's joined a team, I mean, a club that quite often has this reinvigorating impact on people who, you know, similarly lose their way. We saw the same with Di Maria. And the other thing that I would say that's also making this PSG side perhaps now more formidable than any other PSG side in the Qatari era is the fact that Pochettino seems to have a clear idea of what he wants to do in the midfield. You know, we see him getting the best out of Leandro Paredes, you know, and also moving Marco Verratti further forward so that PSG benefit even more from the great creativity that we already know that he has. The only areas I'd say in this PSG side that I really look and see major weaknesses in both of the fullback positions. Cazorla, I thought, did well to recover from conceding the penalty against Barca, and then contributed going forward in the match after that. Florenzi, I'd say, looked a little bit out of his depth, certainly defensively. But again, like Kazawa, once PSG started pushing forward, you saw what he can offer. And, you know, he did play a role in PSG, building up that lead in the second half. So I'd say that there is still room for improvement in some of the positions, but you look at some of the match winners that they have, and it's not even just the attackers as well. You look at Keylor Navas in goal as well. I mean, I know that he made a bit of an uncharacteristic error towards the end of the game against Barca, but otherwise, he's worth, points, victories, alone sometimes in what he's doing between the sticks. So, there are a number of real key performers in this PSG side. And depending on the scenario in any given match, one of these guys can step forward and win PSG the game, whether it's a Champions League final, or a match against sort of a lower ranking Ligue 1 side. And I think Pochettino coming in, with a new energy, new sources of motivation, was important for this PSG side, because they're now going to be able to tap into their potential, which I think was never going to be possible under Tuchel.
All right, and obviously with this being primarily an Italian cultural podcast, I got to ask you about Moise Keane, a player you've kind of mentioned. He has kind of refound himself perhaps this season at PSG. He's really doing outstanding. What have you seen from him, watching him more consistently, that you've liked? And do you think he's going to end up staying at PSG long term? Because I believe it was a loan deal with maybe an option to buy, if I'm not mistaken.
There's no option to buy, which is problematic for PSG. Okay. But there is interest from PSG in keeping him around. And Ken is obviously very happy in Paris as well. I mean, I've been really impressed by Ken so far this season. You look at the numbers that he's putting up. He's already in double digits in Ligue 1. He's got himself a handful of goals in the Champions League as well, and he occasionally chips in with assists. I've been impressed by his versatility, his mentality, his work rate. He's just been a very good signing for PSG. He fits into that squad nicely. Because he's on loan, he's in a position where he can't quite demand regular starts, but he knows he's going to get regular minutes anyway because of some of the things that have been happening this season, with COVID and the crazy schedules. There've been quite a lot of injuries, a lot of rotation, so he's getting a lot of minutes, and he's really rediscovered himself. He's somebody who burst onto the scene at a very young age with Juventus. Perhaps it was a bit too much too soon, or too ambitious to move to the Premier League, especially with a club like Everton, who at that moment in time, without somebody like Ancelotti leading the way, didn't really have enough of a solid plan for how they wanted to launch him into the Premier League and develop him. But he's found a club now where, it seems like if the will is mutual between the two parties, which it certainly seems to be at the moment, it could be a good sort of long-term marriage. But obviously the issue for PSG in this current climate, especially when they're trying to extend the contracts of Neymar and Mbappe at the same time, is going to be how much Everton want for a player where there's no fee agreed in the loan contract. So, Kane has been talking up his hopes that Mancini has been watching what he's doing. I don't think Mancini can be ignoring, some of the stuff that he's doing on the pitch, because sometimes he's taking the responsibility that would fall to an Mbappe or a Neymar, especially in their absence, on his shoulders, and getting the important goals, that these guys are also capable of chipping in with when they're on the pitch. So he's been an absolute godsend at times for PSG so far this season. And I think it would be silly of sporting director Leonardo to at least not look into the possibility of either signing him permanently or trying to extend the loan until PSG are in a better position to potentially launch an option to buy him outright.
Yeah, and you mentioned his hopes of Mancini watching him. I've been saying it, given the form he's been in, it's hard to argue how he doesn't make that Italy Euro squad, assuming this form continues leading up to the summer. So it'll be exciting to see if he makes that team. You've mentioned a little bit about Thomas Tuchel and Pochettino. In your opinion, what's been the biggest difference with this PSG team since they've made that coaching change?
I think the thing that's been most interesting is the change of shape that Pochettino has brought in. Like I mentioned earlier, Verratti's now playing more, further forward, you know, almost like a makeshift number 10. You know, and that brings out the best in his creativity. I mean, you just look at the sublime assist for Mbappe's equaliser the other day. And, you know, it's Verratti at his very best. I mean, that whole performance, that's Verratti in a nutshell. You know, he's walking a tightrope from the very beginning of the match, you know, because he knows that he'll be suspended if he picks up a booking, and yet somehow puts in a perfectly timed tackle on the edge of his own box, you know, and is there providing that sort of, you know, touch of genius in the build-up to that Mbappe equaliser. And then, you know, some of the way that he dictated the pace of the game after that was, you know, was just phenomenal. It's a reminder of, you know, the massive talent that Verratti has, and the reason why Barca, when they didn't have such financial concerns, really wanted to add him to their squad. You know, and I think that Verratti, Pochettino has recognised that PSG's stars are not only Mbappe and Neymar. He also has guys like Verratti, like Marquinhos, like Neves, like Kimpembe, you know, who are potentially very, very important cogs in this PSG machine. And, you know, I think that Pochettino, the big difference between him and Tuchel is there's a positive energy now surrounding him. With Tuchel, it was very negative, almost toxic, especially when you take into account the problems that have been aired quite publicly between him and Leonardo over transfers. You know, and I think that the PSG players are now really thriving in this new atmosphere that Pochettino has brought in. We'll see how long that lasts, you know, because it is possible for you know, these things to disappear after a while, especially in Paris, when, you know, there's a lot of pressure on PSG to be as dominant domestically as they've been since the arrival of the Qataris. So, you know, Pochettino should be under no illusions. It's a fantastic result against Barcelona, but it's just the start of his job. And you know, Tuchel did as much as he could, picked up some good results during his time as PSG boss. You know, got some very good performances out of these star players at times, but ultimately, you know, fell just short in the Champions League. So Pochettino, his mission is now to lead PSG at least one step further than last summer and take them all the way to Champions League success. And the early signs are that, you know, he's tapping into some, you know, sort of potential that Tuchel was, you know, no longer able to access with this group of players.
And you mentioned, one final thing I wanted to ask you, mentioned the amount of like pressure on PSG, obviously, to perform domestically, and they're expected to win the league each year. Looking at the standings, I haven't been following the French league as closely, so forgive my, you know, ignorance on this, but I see Lille are top of the table. They currently have a one-point lead over PSG. Is this Lille team actually good enough to maybe win the league, or in the end, will PSG just emerge victorious, as perhaps many of us expect from the outside?
I mean, this Lille team is a very good team. You know, they have a very, very good manager, a guy I rate very highly, Christophe Galtier. And I mean, you will have seen, you know, covering AC Milan in European competition, what they're capable of when they're at their best, because they performed phenomenally well. I remember when they were away against AC Milan, and they kind of lost a bit of momentum towards the end of the group stage, which cost them top spot. They're now up against Ajax this week, and we'll see how they get on. You know, but Lille, the concern for them between now and the end of the season, from my point of view, is how they handle the return of continental action and how much longer they stay in the Europa League, you know, because we've seen teams, very, very good teams, you know, clubs capable of fielding very strong starting 11s, struggle, you know, in terms of depth in the latter stages of the season, particularly domestically. I mean, you look at the difference that being out of Europe has made to Rennes, for example, who are now back in the reckoning for a European place. And I think the other thing as well that's pushing the likes of Lille and the likes of PSG this season domestically is having two very big teams in Lyon and Monaco who don't have any continental competition at all. So they're able to put together greater runs of consistency. You know, and I think PSG Monaco this Sunday is going to be a really fantastic watch. And I'm curious to see exactly how Lille, you know, handle going up against you know, quite a tricky Lorient side that beat PSG just a couple of weeks ago. Once they come back from this clash against Ajax, you know, there's a lot can change in a short space of time in France. It's just nice to have such a tight title race for the first time in quite a while.
Yeah, no, it definitely looks like a tight title race. Same thing going on in Italy. It's much more enjoyable, right, as like a neutral to watch a close title race than just one team perhaps blowing out the competition, unless it's your team that you're a fan of, obviously. I can't thank you enough, Jonathan, for taking the time to provide your thoughts on PSG and all the insight you provided. Keep up all the great work you're doing and definitely stay safe and hope to talk to you again soon.
Likewise, my friend. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on and speak to you soon.
All right. Take care.
So that will do it for the 41st episode of the Calcio Corner podcast. I hope you have enjoyed it. A special thank you to Patrick Kendrick and Jonathan Johnson for both joining me on this episode and taking the time to provide their great insight. Once again, please be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Audioboom. Feel free to leave a rating and comment. That would be greatly appreciated to help us grow our content. And until next time, guys, ciao.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Calcio Corner podcast with your host, Raffaele. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains August 15th through the 18th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.